Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Lobel, and at 1400 GMT on Tuesday, the 5th of November, these are our main stories. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, has said the country will begin enriching uranium again at an underground site in a major breach of the international deal on its nuclear program. There's been a horrific attack as Mexico endures a brutal drugs war. Mormon mothers and their children are killed during a family road trip. Also in this podcast, presiding over protests. Chile's president says he's not budging and hits out at the anti-government action on the streets of Santiago.
That violence cannot be admitted. That's not within the law.
And some potentially groundbreaking news for women, a possible alternative to invasive smear tests for cervical cancer. It's another blow to the previously celebrated deal which restricted Iran's use of nuclear power in an exchange for sanctions being lifted. The Iranian government says it'll resume enriching uranium at an underground site south of Tehran. Iran began breaking commitments earlier this year, following President Trump's decision to abandon the accord. The other signatories to the deal have begun to react, with the EU saying it is concerned by the announcement. A response Iran's President Hassan Rouhani certainly expected.
We are taking this step from Wednesday, and I will give the order to the Atomic Energy Organization and instruct them to do so. We will start gas injection at Fordo. They might start making a fuss about it, asking us, why do you want to do this in Fordo? We know all about that.
Well, BBC Persian special correspondent Kazra Naji told me why President Rouhani has made this decision.
It's a cry of help, Iranian style, in the sense that Iran is telling the international community, particularly the EU countries, Britain, France and Germany particularly, that they have to be able to sell their oil. And if they cannot sell their oil, there's no point in them staying in this deal, the JCPOA, the nuclear deal that Iran signed with the international community in 2015. The basis of that agreement was that Iran, the old sanctions against Iran would be lifted in return for Iran curtailing its nuclear agreement. Now, because of the U.S. sanctions, Iran cannot sell its oil. It doesn't have access to its banking channels abroad. So Iran is saying that you have to do something to the Europeans or there's no point in staying in this deal.
So a cry for help, but the international community really looking very closely at this to work out whether the deal, the nuclear deal, is close to collapse. Can anything save it now?
It's very difficult. I remember Federica Mogherini, foreign affairs chief of the EU, just a couple of months ago. She was sounding very unsure that this deal could be held together much longer because of the pressure from the Americans. President Trump has reimposed sanctions on Iran, very severe sanctions, that makes a mockery of this basic premise of this deal.
Kazra Naji. And now staying with Iran, Robert Levinson, a former US FBI agent, disappeared there in 2007. The American administration has now offered a reward of up to $20 million for information about him. He's believed to be America's longest held hostage. My colleague Alan Kasuja has been speaking to Robert Levinson's daughter, Sarah.
My father was a retired FBI agent. He was doing private business. He was both investigating cigarette smuggling as well as doing private contract work for the CIA, for the U.S. government. I'm not sure all of the details of exactly what he was investigating, but I know he was over there both for private business and for the U.S. government.
And then what happened to him?
From our understanding and our belief, he was picked up by officials on Kish Island in Iran. He left his hotel room at the Hotel Miriam in Kish Island. And somewhere between leaving the hotel and the airport, we believe, was arrested. An eyewitness shared with us and with the media that he witnessed him being arrested. And from that point forward, we have had no information from the Iranian regime as to what happened to him, aside from an article that was released by a state-sanctioned media outlet, Press TV, stating he was in the hands of Iranian officials.
How long ago was that article?
That article was in April of 2007, so 12 and a half years ago. We received proof of life in 2010 and 2011 from an unknown group, but it was later believed to be the Iranian government.
What have you had since then?
little piecemeal reports of sightings of him from various people. All signs have pointed to him being still alive. We haven't been able to determine his exact whereabouts. From our understanding, we believe that he's being moved to keep his location a secret. We know that there is a UN working group that has deemed that Iran was responsible and needed to send him home to us. And now we've had a reward announced by the U.S. Department of State called Rewards for Justice, and it's specific to my father offering up to $20 million to send him home to us. And this combined with the $5 million reward that was already existing from our FBI, a total of $25 million, we're hoping will compel someone to come forward and send him home to us.
When relations between the U.S. and Iran have not been great, I wonder how that has affected you as a family and affected your hope.
We always keep hope alive. We have been through three U.S. administrations. We've seen the relationship with Iran go up and down in ebbs and flows, and it hasn't brought our father home yet. For the past 12 and a half years, we've been frustrated at the lack of any information to get him home to us. So today, with this new reward, we're hoping that something happens as a result.
Tell me about how your family is coping with all this.
We stay very close. We talk through it. We support each other all the time. When one person is sad, another of us is there to pick them up. It goes through cycles for all of us. It's been hell for 12 and a half years.
And a lot has happened in the family in 12 and a half years.
My father has 9 grandchildren. He's only met one of them, and he disappeared when Ryan was 4 months old. He has a new grandson as of 3 months ago. We've had 4 weddings now. He's missed 3 daughters walking down the aisle and 1 son. So much more. And we just want him home. We want him home to live a quiet life with his family.
To Mexico now, where a convoy of Mormon families were on their way from the northern state of Sonora to Chihuahua when their cars came under fire. According to relatives of the victims, 3 mothers and their 6 children were ambushed and murdered in their vehicles by what local journalists believe were members of a drugs cartel. A relative of those who died saw the burnt-out cars.
This is for the record. Nita and 4 of my grandchildren are burnt and shot up. Right on the road out of La Mora.
Well, our Latin America editor, Vanessa Bush-Luter, told us more about the attack.
The details are still emerging, so it's still relatively unclear. In that clip there, we heard a man referring to Nita. That's short for Ronita Miller LeBaron, who is one of the confirmed victims who died in the car. And alongside her, 4 of her children died. 2 babies, twin babies, and an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. What we know is that group was traveling from one town to another town to visit relatives, and they were traveling in 3 SUVs. And it seems like they were ambushed by a drugs gang. It's not quite clear whether one of the cars was ambushed first. This one car had a puncture, apparently, and the other 2 cars had gone back to the nearby town to get help. But what we know is that in that first car, that mother with the 4 children was killed. They were shot at, and then the vehicle was either set alight or caught fire when the hail of bullets hit it.
And what more do we know about the victims and their citizenship?
We believe that some of them may be dual nationals. They come from a community that was established by Mormons in the first half of the 20th century. They've been living there, this community, for a long time. Many of them are Mormons, but some Catholics have also moved into the area. This area has been beset by violence by 2 warring drug gangs. So there has been a lot of violence there. And this community has taken a very firm stand against it. One member of the LeBaron family was kidnapped 9 years ago or 10 years ago. ago in 2009. And he was kidnapped for ransom. And the community said, we're not going to pay money to get him back because that will only encourage more kidnapping. So they took a stand. And actually, this man, Eric LeBaron, was released without any ransom being paid.
And very briefly, is this small town of Bavispe known for violence?
Not the town itself, but this area in the north of Mexico is where many of the drug smuggling routes run through. And there are two local gangs aligned to rival drug cartels. One is the Sinaloa cartel, the other one is the Juarez cartel, who are at war to control this area and the lucrative drug routes through it.
Vanessa Buschluter. Chile's president, Sebastián Piñera, is struggling to control more than 2 weeks of protests in the capital, Santiago. More than 20 people have been killed after disputes about a metro fare hike ignited a wider anti-government movement. So far, the president has increased wages and pensions and reshuffled his cabinet in reaction to the unrest. But he's faced fierce criticism over the security force's harsh crackdown on protesters. President Piñera sat down with the BBC's Katie Watson to address the ongoing violence on the streets and public concerns over living standards in his country.
In the last 2 weeks, we have experienced two different phenomena of very different nature. First, and this was absolutely unexpected, a huge wave of destruction, violence, that some people put in place in a very organized way. That violence cannot be admitted. That's not within the law. Another story, a very different story, is the legitimate manifestation and protest of the Chilean citizens. First of all, we had to recover public order and protect the safety of our citizens. The second thing we did was to put in place a very strong social agenda that is taking care of many of the demands and requests of the people. So we are listening and we are reacting. But of course, people have the right to protest. And we recognize that and we protect that right because that's part of our democracy.
It doesn't feel like that right's being protected. I've seen parents running crazily with their children in buggies away from tear gas being thrown, water cannon, and these are peaceful demonstrations.
When there are these organized crime groups that use all kind of violence.
But that's a small amount. There was a protest of more than a million
people. It's a small amount, of course. That's why I made a clear distinction between those organized groups that are willing to destroy everything. And we cannot allow that. At the same time, we have millions of Chileans that are protesting.
There's widespread condemnation of your forces, not just the army, but the police, of using excessive force on peaceful protesters. The UN is currently in the country. How can you as a leader sit there and let that happen? Because there are people who are scared seeing the police on the street.
I can guarantee you that for me and for my government, the commitment with human rights is the most high and most strong commitment I can have. And that's why we took all the precautions. Of course, there are many alleged complaints about excessive use of force or even crimes. If that took place, I can guarantee you that will be investigated by our prosecutor system and it will be judged by our judiciary system. There will be no impunity.
The Chilean President Sebastián Piñera talking to Katie Watson. Coming up in this podcast, with less than a year until we find out who the next US president is, it's still not clear who will challenge Donald Trump.
I don't want to say anything negative about Bernie, but he's getting old, man.
What about Joe Biden?
Forget it. He's too old school. I'll take him over Trump, though.
And what if more cities were designed by women? Could they be different, maybe even better, for everyone? We'll have a special report from Barcelona. It's an operation involving six countries, but then it's about rather a lot of money too. Malaysian investigators say they're working with five countries to recover $4 billion worth of assets bought with money stolen from the state investment fund 1MDB. It's the latest twist in the investigation into what happened to vast sums of money that were meant to fuel economic growth in Malaysia. Our Asia Pacific editor Michael Bristow told me more about the case.
Well, just to step back a little bit, 1MDB, this was a government investment fund. Essentially, Malaysia tried to, it borrowed lots of money about 10 years ago, supposedly to fuel economic growth, but most of the money appears to have been stolen. Over the last year, since the new government took office in Malaysia, a lot of that money has been recovered, but a lot of it has not. Up until now, we've been unclear exactly how much money we're talking about, but it appeared to run into the billions. What the Malaysian government has done today, he's actually put a figure on that, about $4.3 billion, which it thinks was taken from the fund. It's going to investigate where this money went. It's investigating with five other countries. They haven't given much details, officials, so we're not exactly sure what this money was spent on. In fact, they don't appear to know exactly where it is, but they think they know the figure that they're trying to find.
OK, so they know the figure, but what more do we know about the main suspect they seem to have in their sights?
Yeah, this is a gentleman called Jolo, a businessman who is wanted in connection with the theft of this money. He's on the run at the moment. Interestingly, he hasn't gone to ground. So he runs a website, for example, giving his point of view. And just last week, he came to an agreement with the US authorities to hand over $700 million worth of assets to the US authorities. So people know where he is. And in fact, the Malaysians themselves say we know where he is. They haven't named the country, but they know where he's living. What the Malaysians are saying is that the country where he's living, the authorities there were refusing to cooperate with them and hand him over. They also say that he's had plastic surgery in order to avoid detection, and he appears to be going around the world on a Cypriot passport. So he's still on the run, although some people know where he is.
Michael Bristow. A year today, we will all know America's verdict on Donald Trump's first 4 years in office, whether he's been handed the keys to the Oval Office for another 4 years or booted out. In a viscerally divided country, right now, many Republicans show every sign of sticking by President Trump as he faces an impeachment inquiry. But there's still no one clear frontrunner among Democratic Party contenders. Our Washington correspondent Jane O'Brien has gone to New Hampshire to take the pulse amongst voters there. The state holds the first Democratic primary in February and will be an early indicator of how the rest of the country may be thinking.
Bernie Sanders, the 78-year-old senator from Vermont, is a hot ticket in New Hampshire. One of the prime instigators of the Democratic Party's lurch to the left, he remains a firebrand of the socialist movement. But while he still commands the brand, following his recent heart attack, some supporters at this rally in the college town of Keene question his fire.
I'm afraid that his time has passed and that we need him to stay in the Senate.
He doesn't have the oomph. And I don't want to say anything negative about Bernie, but he's getting old, man.
What about Joe Biden?
Forget it.
No.
He's too old school. We got to move. We got to go forward. I'll take him over Trump, though.
Democrats certainly have plenty of alternatives. The field is huge, and the serious contenders won't fully emerge until voting in Iowa early next year and the first primary here in New Hampshire. That's why this state is so important, and the reason every candidate keeps coming back.
How many of you noticed stores closing around where you live here in New Hampshire? And why are those stores closing?
Amazon.
Tech entrepreneur Andrew Yang is 44 and calls himself the math guy. He's betting that concern in the White Mountain region about jobs and wages that helped propel Donald Trump to the White House in 2016 remains a key issue. But perhaps more surprising was the subject he didn't mention.
We heard a lot about policy tonight, but the thing we didn't hear about, which has been consuming Washington, is impeaching President Trump. Why don't you think that was mentioned here?
We're just sick and tired of hearing about it. We don't even know what's going on. It's more government just beating each other up, the two parties beating each other up. That's not a good way to do it. We want to look to the future.
There's also the possibility that come the general election, impeachment will mobilize Republican voters who believe the president is the victim of a political witch hunt. Turnout will be crucial in New Hampshire, where Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump by less than 0.5% in 2016. Professor Andy Smith is a veteran pollster at the University of New Hampshire.
People have to remember that when you get into politics,
the tribalism of the parties trumps everything. Republicans root for the Republican candidate no matter who it is. The Democrats will root for the Democratic candidate no matter who that is. And I don't think that's going to change in this election. I don't think that any impeachment inquiry, or if it goes to a full impeachment and trial in the Senate, will change that either. Both parties are using this to their advantage because they see this as a base mobilization election.
Bernie Sanders won the New Hampshire primary in 2016, but right now the vast majority of Democratic voters don't know who they want and could wait until the very last minute to make up their minds. Whatever they decide, though, will influence the course of the party and eventually the presidential election itself.
Jane O'Brien reporting. If you think of Canada, you probably think of fresh, clean, wide, open spaces, forests, lakes even. So maybe it's a bit surprising to hear that there's a lead problem in the country's water. University researchers and journalists have spent a year conducting a major investigation and found that hundreds of thousands of Canadians have been unwittingly exposed to high levels of lead in their drinking water. It's wider and more serious than the famous lead contamination in Flint, Michigan, 5 years ago. My colleague Lawrence Pollard has been talking to Bruce Lanphier, a leading Canadian water safety researcher who was a consultant on the investigation, and asked him where this contamination was coming from.
Predominantly from the lead service line, so very similar to Flint. There's also lead solder that's sometimes used in the pipes inside the homes, as well as brass fittings that can contain up to 8% lead. So it can come from all of those. And if you don't make sure that the water is right, if you don't do the corrosion control, then the lead will be leached from all of those metal components. And we haven't been doing it. Most of our regulations in Canada are based upon guidance levels. That is, they aren't enforced. And so in some cases, like with air pollution, which is visible, we do a pretty good job with those guidance. But if it's insidious, like with lead, we haven't done such a good job.
But this is a fascinating thing. The fact that Canada is one of the only developed countries in the world that doesn't have a nationwide drinking water standard and presumably also doesn't have a testing system. Have I understood that right?
Call it haphazard and non-uniform. And again, it's not an enforced standard. Now, we have recently this past year lowered the allowable levels down to 5 parts per billion. That's amongst the lowest in the world. Mm. So in that way, perhaps you can see this as optimistic that we're beginning to better understand the problem. How we got here is surprising, troubling, but we have brought down levels that are allowable. And I think this story is really going to break things open.
Just give us an idea, what are the dangers of the lead poisoning and what severity are you finding in the water in Canada? Is it enough to damage people and how?
It is, and it does damage people, but it does it, again, insidiously. It's the chronic low-level exposures that have wear and tear on the body or damage the developing brain or during pregnancy will result in a child being born too soon. In adults, we will see atherosclerosis or coronary heart disease from the constant wear and tear. And in the laboratory, you can see when you add lead, you see the same types of damage happening that we see with coronary heart disease. And so it's these slow diseases that unfold over years and decades. And so we don't see lead. We see heart attacks or we see children having problems in school, but we don't make the connection back to the lead contamination. If we want people to stay healthy, then it's really largely about making sure that the environment they live in is safe. We can continue to put all of our health dollars into treatment and finding cures, but if people want to be healthy, it's more about where we live.
Now, some potentially groundbreaking news for women. A smear test to detect cervical cancer is an invasive and sometimes uncomfortable procedure. But now researchers here in England have developed a new test which analyses urine and vaginal samples collected by the women themselves. It may still be years away, though, and will need to be tested thoroughly before going into wider circulation. Dr. Belinda Nedjai from Queen Mary University in London is part of the study team. She told us how this new test works.
So what you do, you take urine of a vaginal nerve sample, so that's the woman, they will take that. They will send this to our laboratory. In the laboratory, we will extract the DNA from it and we'll evaluate if there is any changes in the DNA that will tell us whether there is a high risk of precancer lesion or lesion, because we calculate a score with our classifier. This is pretty straightforward. The cell swapping devices are like a cotton bud, quite simple. And the urine test that we've been using is also a simple test. Actually, the first purpose of this test is really to be used for women who, for some reason, cannot attend the screening program because they can't physically come, or, you know, older women that find it very painful to have like a smear test. So for those women, we're hoping something like in a year that we could, that potentially we can implement that in a year or two. But for like a larger scale implementation in the whole screening program, this is going to take from 3 to 5 years because we need to do a large scale, if you want, confirmation trial enrolling about 10,000 women.
Dr. Belinda Najai of Queen Mary University. Cities are supposed to be built for all of us, but they haven't been built by all of us. Generations and generations of men have put their mark on urban design. But what if more cities were designed by women? Could they be different, maybe even better for everyone? The BBC's population reporter Stephanie Hegarty has been to Barcelona to see how a feminist movement is transforming the city, spearheaded by its first female mayor.
Conchi Barrocos is walking down a dark street on the outskirts of Barcelona. Under these high-rise tower blocks, the streets are deathly quiet. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. She scurries past the scary parts, pointing out where there's no light at all. Conchi has to do this walk almost every morning because she's a cleaner at a hospital and it's too early for public transport.
It's something that nobody thinks about. How do people travel at 3 or 4 in the morning? They don't think about matching your working hours with the availability of public transport.
How safe we feel, especially at night, is just one of thousands of ways that men and women experience a city differently. That's something that Sara Ortiz and Blanca Valdivia have been obsessing about for over a decade. They set up Punt 6, a collective of architects, sociologists, and urban planners, to study the different ways that men and women use space. And they're particularly obsessed with things like benches and toilets.
We need to eat more often, and also, because of our menstrual cycle, we need toilets for more things.
Benches are not just for socializing. They're a basic necessity for mobility, for people who are sick, for people with disabilities, and for carers or childminders.
Four years ago, Barcelona elected its first female mayor. Ada Colau has embarked on a profoundly feminist agenda.
The government of Barcelona is explicitly feminist. In fact, one of the first things we did was to name a councillor of feminism and LGBTI rights, and we put it at the centre of our policies.
She's putting young women in key posts.
Okay.
Hola.
Hi.
Janet Sanz is Barcelona's councillor for urbanism and is implementing one of the city's most ambitious projects. She wants to take back the streets from cars. Research by Punt 6, the collective, says that the majority of drivers in Barcelona are men. Women tend to travel more by foot or on public transport.
About 60% of Barcelona's public space is occupied by cars, either while driving or parked. The moment you redistribute that space and make the use of the space more equal, you're supporting groups that until now have had no access to that space. What we have to prevent is the situation where the strongest take up the most space, in this case, the car.
I'm standing in the middle of the street where parents are zipping by on their scooters with their kids taking them to school. Instead of cars and traffic, I'm surrounded in benches and plant boxes. The effect is to block this junction off from traffic, creating a mini park in the middle of the street. It's called the Superia, Superblocks. The Superblocks were designed by Salvador Hueda, a man, but they've been implemented with gusto by Sanz and her team. There's 6 superblocks in Barcelona so far, and the plan is to create more than 500. And getting the community involved has been crucial.
We've done something really cool here. A few years ago, we did these exploratory marches with women who live in the area. We went and they said, the light doesn't work here, or we don't have any benches here. And we started these days where you could come to the town hall and say, in my area, we're missing all these things I need.
Ada Colau and her team can't show us what a city would look like if it was built by women.
It's obvious that in 5 years you can't overcome 2,000 years of patriarchy.
But they can give us a glimpse of what a city might look like if everyone had a seat at the table.
And for more stories on how women can change the future, go to bbc.com/100women. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, a quick update on that story from Mexico we brought you earlier in the podcast. Police and the armed forces are now searching for several children who fled when their relatives were killed in an ambush by a suspected drugs cartel. There will be more on that in our updated version of the Global News podcast a little later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Lobel. Until next time, goodbye.